Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IEEE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And even though it is a little rainy here this Thursday morning in New York, it is still a gorgeous day. We've been having beautiful, beautiful weather this weekend. For Father's Day weekend, it's supposed to be gorgeous. And I welcome all this rain because it means I don't have to spend hours watering. So it's all perfect. Anyway, I'm very excited to have all of you on with me today. My guest will be Dr. Elise Golan. She is the Director for Sustainable Development at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And she will tell us more about what she does and the work they're doing within the USDA to address sustainability. And so I'm very excited to have her on, and she'll tell us more about what she's doing in just a little bit. But first, I want to talk to you about some things going on in and around the news, some events coming up, share my recipe with you, et cetera, before I bring Dr. Golan on. So first in the news, this week I wrote about a great article about yoga being good for the brain. And as we get older, you know, I always talk about food as nourishing the body, but I really look at our bodies as a whole, you know, look at it from all different angles, wellness, health, sustainability, and yoga fits right in there. Yoga is a wonderful way not only to help your body become more flexible, but it focuses your mind and helps you stay on target and helps develop mindfulness in everything you do. And so I've been doing yoga for the better part of 40 years on and off. I certainly have had many times where I've been off, but every time I come back, my heart opens. I really, literally, if I've been away from it too long and I get to a first yoga class, I can't hold back the tears. I cry because I feel like I'm back home. It's just so comforting. And yoga is something I know I can always fall back on. I can always go back to the breathing. I can always slow things down by remembering mindfulness and yoga. So for those that haven't tried it, I encourage you to. I have an internship program over the summer where I have young people from college come and work with me in my garden and in the kitchen, learning about sustainability and organic foods and cooking delicious vegetarian food. And every Thursday, we start the day by going to a yoga class. We'll go right after the radio show. We head off to a yoga class, and I've had many comments where they really appreciate it because they have not had the experience, and they really see this internship as a whole body-mind experience, which is how life should be. So if you haven't tried yoga, I recommend giving it a try. There's yoga classes all over the place, but do try to find one that has a little bit of a spiritual element to it. Yoga without the mindfulness is really just a glorified exercise class. So, you know, where yoga classes at the gym can be good, you have to really be careful, find the right teacher. If it doesn't feel right, don't give up on yoga. Try another teacher because you really have to find someone that resonates with you. So anyway, I hope you all give that a try. There was also a great article about overeating, starting with babies. And research has shown that if you give babies a really big baby bottle for those that are feeding formula, you end up with a bigger baby. So the first thing I'd recommend is to breastfeed, obviously. That's the best for the baby. But if for whatever reason you can't or you back to work and you've been, pumping milk, but even pumping milk, you just want to be mindful of how much milk you're giving to your baby. Early on, you can really set them on the right track by, you know, giving them enough, of course, but not overfeeding them. And then also this week there was a World Meat-Free Day on Monday, and it is just a wonderful day to raise awareness about the impact that meat production, especially industrial meat production, has on the planet. And, they talk about if just 10,000 people would go meat-free for just one day, you'd save enough water for one person for 93 years and the CO2 equivalent of driving a car 180,000 miles. So just imagine if everybody gave up meat one day, or if everybody just cut down on meat, you know, those people that eat meat three times a day, what would happen if you ate meat only once a day? It would really have a big impact. And one of the petitions that I also have on my newsletter this week is to encourage the Food Network to introduce a vegan show to their market. With so many people who are trying to make that transition but really don't know how, cooking shows have been an amazing way to get people back into the kitchen and cooking. And it would be a real service if the Food Network would help us teach people how to cook healthy. And I've approached them before, and I think I will approach them again about doing a cooking show. I realize that so often, you know, one of the biggest reasons they probably wouldn't want to support someone like me in the cooking show is because the products I use are not the products that advertise on, typically on the Food Network. I'd be trashing so many of the products. So, you know, they're going to have to do a little work, a little homework to get some companies who care about the quality of the products that they're producing to advertise on the TV show so that it would be in alignment with what a vegan cooking show would show. But anyway, I think it's a great idea. So there is a petition on my website. Every week I put a couple of petitions up to ask people to sign. More and more I'm trying to get people involved in speaking up, and I realize as I've gotten older, policy really is where it's at. Without setting the policy, there's not going to be any change. And we can see how the changing policies, you know, they take a long time, but they do change over time, and it's just amazing. I mean, look, we've had an African-American president in the White House for 8 years. Who would have thought that? We are going to have our first woman president nominee. Who would have thought that? Gay marriage is legal. Let's not start about the tragedy in Orlando. That was heartbreaking. But we have seen change in a lot of areas, and food is one of them. More and more people are realizing that the food production in this country is really not good for their health or the planet, and are trying to make that change. So, you know, it all starts with policy, and we need to all speak out. And having the internet and emails really makes it very easy. There's no excuse for anyone to say, I don't have time. All you have to do is click. Of course, if you want to sit down and write a letter, that even has more impact, but at least participate in these petitions. So I also have a petition to ask Aldi, which is a very large nationwide grocery store chain, to reduce their plastic. And then I also put a suggestion in there that we should ask Trader Joe's to do the same. But basically, you know, you want to buy organic food, but at the same time, you don't want to buy everything that's wrapped in plastic. It's just so wasteful. So maybe we can help change that around. And then there's also a petition to stop the merger of Bayer and Monsanto. Could you imagine? If they merged, they would own 30% of the world's seed supply. We also have ChemChina and Syngenta merging. You know, these mergers, you know, DuPont and Dow, these mergers are just really, really bad. I know, you know, we've had a law in place that has prevented these conglomerates from merging together to have control, but somehow they're getting around these laws, and we need to speak up and prevent that from happening. I mean, Monsanto is a really bad company. Bayer is not much better. DuPont, Dow, they all have their problems, and you put them together, it's just horrific, the thought. So please sign those petitions. Some great things are going on in around the city this weekend and in the near future I want to share with you. This weekend there's a strawberry festival out on the East End in Mattituck. That's the East End of Long Island. It's a three-day festival starting today, fireworks every night. And they're going to have, you know, a strawberry queen is crowned. But it's a strawberry festival, great food, you know, lots of activities, rides. It should be fun for the whole family. So if you are out on the East End or making a trip out there this weekend for Father's Day, check out the strawberry festival. It's at the Mattituck Lions Club. Also, there is Dr. Will Tuttle. He is the author of The World Peace Diet. He is being sponsored by Healthy Planet out here in Huntington, at the Huntington Library on June 18th. And, you know, he promotes vegan cooking and vegan diet for peace of the world. And that should be a great event. And actually, the talk starts at 2, and then it's followed by a dinner. The talk is free, and then the dinner, everyone is invited to across the street at an Asian bistro. June 21st, a dear friend of mine, Wendy Gordon, is celebrating her first novel with a book signing out at the Book Review in Huntington. That's at 7 p.m. on June 21st. June 26th, Slow Food North Shore is celebrating a summer solstice celebration here at the I.E. Green Homestead. Bring a dish to share, $5 for members, $10 for non-members is the suggested donation. But, of course, everyone is welcome. We will have music, swimming, volleyball. Should be really fun. Let's welcome in the summer together at the IE Green Homestead. Please come. June 26th, there is also an edible and medicinal walk during the day. So you can actually do both. Go to the edible and medicinal walk during the day, which is out at Restoration Farm in Amityville, with the natural nurse Ellen Kamai. She's also a guest on the PRN as well, and she's a master in natural medicine and herbal medicine. She's just really great and so knowledgeable. And she'll be doing it along with the master herbalist Eugene Zambirian, who's a natural doctor. And they'll walk the gardens at Restoration Farm, identifying different edible and medicinal herbs, and then they're going to make some salves and cough medicine and tinctures. So that should be a really fun thing. That costs $45. And you can sign up at the Natural Nurse website. July 8th through the 17th, out at the Southampton Elks Lodge, there is a Long Island Food Truck Rodeo. And it's going to be live entertainment, local beer and wine, craft vendors, farmers markets, all week long, so you might want to check that out if you're out on the East End. July 18th, the Long Island Food Coalition and Slow Food North Shore are sponsoring a trip out to the Rodale Institute, which is in Kutztown, Pennsylvania. It is a 350-acre organic research farm, and we will be touring the farm, having an organic agricultural workshop, a bag lunch, and we have hired a luxury bus to take us all there from Long Island. So you can go to the Long Island Food Coalition website to find out more information to purchase tickets to that. July 23rd is a farm-to-table benefit dinner out at Catskey Farm in Kinderhook, and this benefits the Sylvia Center's Learning Garden, which is on the Lower East Side and helps kids from poor neighborhoods really get their hands in the kitchen making some healthy food and learning about healthy food. So it's a great program, and their farm supports all that work. And that's it. Now I would like to share my recipe with you before I invite my guest on. This week, my recipe is actually, it's kind of funny, it's a mistake. I was making my vegan chocolate chip cookies, and they didn't come out so well, or the batter didn't come out well, and I knew I did something wrong, so I added some applesauce and a few other things and cooked them, and they came out great, and everybody loved them. They came out like lace cookies, so now I call them my gluten-free vegan lace chocolate chip cookies, and they're really great. So I recreated the recipe, and I'm sharing it with all of you. I shared these cookies out at the Rising Tide Natural Food 40th anniversary celebration, which took place this past weekend, where we had a table. Slow Food North Shore is also having tables every weekend at the Port Washington Farmers Market, the Seacliff Farmers Market, every other weekend at the Huntington Farmers Market. So come out and visit Slow Food if you're at any of those markets. Okay, these gluten-free vegan lace chocolate chip cookies. Start with 1 cup of coconut oil, 1/2 cup of organic brown sugar, 1/2 cup of organic white sugar, 1 tablespoon apple cider vinegar, 1 tablespoon vanilla, and 1/4 cup of organic applesauce. And you're going to mix those together in an electric mixer. Mix the dry ingredients in a separate bowl, and that is 1 cup of Pamela's gluten-free vegan flour mix, 1 cup of organic gluten-free oats that I've pulsed in a food processor for a few seconds. So it's not completely smooth like a flour. It's a little lumpy, but it's not as big as the chunks of just oatmeal straight. A half a teaspoon of salt, a half a teaspoon baking soda, a half a teaspoon baking powder, 1 teaspoon cinnamon, a quarter teaspoon nutmeg, and 1 1/4 cups of organic chocolate chips. So you're going to cream the coconut oil, the brown sugar, and white sugar in an electric mixer first for about 5 minutes. Then add the apple cider vinegar, the applesauce, and the vanilla and mix that up. Then in the separate bowl, you're going to mix all those dry ingredients together, and then you're going to slowly add them 1 cup at a time to the mixing bowl, the electric mixer, and mix that up. Then at the end, you're going to add the chocolate chip cookies. And I line a large cookie sheet with parchment paper and spray it with a little bit of oil. And drop the cookies onto the parchment paper. And I alternate. I do like 4 on one row, 3 on the other, so that there's room for them to spread out and not touch each other. And the cookies are about 1/4 in diameter, size of 1/4 in diameter. So I don't make them too big because they really do spread out. And bake them for about 8 minutes. If your pan is hotter in the back, halfway through, turn the pan around so that the back doesn't burn. And then let them cool before transferring them to a cookie platter. And that's it. Super easy to make, really delicious, lots of fun, and they are really lacy and crispy and delicate. So enjoy, and let me know how you like them. Okay, and so now it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Elise Golan. As I said before, she's the Director for Sustainable Development at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And in that role, she's responsible for planning, coordinating, and analyzing all of the department's policies, programs, and activities, and takes a look at how they impact sustainable agriculture, natural resources, and community development, including food security. And so it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Golan. Are you with us, Elise?
Yes, here I am. Hello. It's nice to be with you. Of course, now my mouth is watering for chocolate chip cookies, but I'm going to charge on. That sounded delicious.
They are so easy to make, and they are delicious. So let me know if you make them, or stop by the IE Green Homestead anytime, and I always have a batch of some sort of good cookies on hand. So anyway, I just thought before I get started with a whole bunch of questions, you could just share with us a little bit more of what you do as the Director for Sustainable Development at the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Sure. I'll go ahead and give you maybe a little bit of a history of this position. I'm the third person in this position. It was created by the Secretary of Agriculture in 1996, which Dan Glickman. And it was created primarily in response to what was happening internationally. We had some big movements towards a more holistic thinking about agriculture and its place in a sustainable world. So we had the Brundtland Report that talked about sustainability. We had the UN Rio conference that was about sustainability. And so for the first time, the world was coming to terms with this term and what it meant. And the Secretary Glickman said, you know, we need to have someone in USDA that really has the responsibility of integrating this new way of thinking. Actually, it's a very, very old way of thinking, but integrating this new attention on sustainability into the department's programs and activities. So he created this position. And I would say that in the beginning, this position was very outward-looking. It was mostly about negotiating with our UN colleagues, other countries and member groups about sustainability and sustainable agriculture. So it was very much focused on the international discussion. When I took this position, you know, thinking about what was happening internationally and what were some of the major gaps in U.S. efforts to build sustainable supply chains and sustainable food systems, I thought about food loss and waste. I mean, it would be impossible to think that given the enormous amounts of food loss and waste in the world, about a third. FAO estimates it's about a third of the global food supply. And then domestically, we also estimate that it's about a third of our food supply, and that's just at the end of the chain. But given that those enormous amounts and their impact on so many aspects of sustainability, I thought this really is something that my office should try to spearhead, that this really is something that we should take on as part of a major effort to make food supply chains in the United States more sustainable. And lucky for me, Secretary Vilsack, the current Secretary of Agriculture, he was thinking similarly and jumped on this and said, absolutely, this is something the USDA needs to spearhead.
Yeah, well, I've talked a lot lately about food loss and food waste, and the amount that is wasted is huge. And yet looking at it, you know, I realize that it's very different how food is wasted in this country versus how it might be in Africa. Can you share with my listeners a little bit? I know you actually differentiate between food loss and food waste. Can you talk a little bit about those differences and how you see that, how they impact the world differently?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So we do know that when we're looking at this continuum of food loss and waste, we tend to think of food loss as post-harvest loss, the amount of food that is lost directly after the harvest. So from harvest to maybe first-line processing or marketing, but it's that harvest to storage component of the supply chain. And we know that that part, that that loss is very large in the developing world. This is where you're going to see pest infestation in storage containers or storage, you know, grain storage that's exposed to the elements, or inefficient transportation systems that result in huge losses of quality and safety of food as it gets from farmers to markets, or even as it gets from, you know, when a farmer harvested to when it's time for them to eat it, you know, 3 months later. And so we're seeing huge amounts of waste, of loss there. And then as you move on to some of the more developed economies, you're seeing efficient transportation systems, efficient storage systems, more efficient infrastructures that lead to very low amounts of that post-harvest loss. But when you get to our economies where you're seeing major loss and waste is at the household level. And that's where, you know, the retail and household level, the end of the chain. And you've probably noticed that I keep saying food loss and waste, and I keep kind of mushing those terms. So when we started this discussion about food loss and waste so many years ago, we pretty much had this kind of distinction between what happened at the farm level, loss, and what happened at the consumer level, waste. But we're realizing it's more of a continuum. And the FAO has moved towards using those two terms in conjunction. We talk about food loss and waste as the umbrella term, and we know that a component of food loss and waste is this waste element, which we're now thinking more of almost intentional wasting of wholesome, nutritious food. So it almost has this kind of, you know, intentional meaning right now. And at USDA, we have always used the word food loss as the umbrella term, recognizing that a component of food loss is that food waste element.
Right. You know, we talk about food waste in countries like ours more on the household level. However, I've seen so many, like, documentaries, you know, with Will Allen, you know, at, you know, showing, you know, cases and cases of produce that are, that has, like, one rotten orange in it, and so they toss the whole case at the, you know, the food shed, you know, at, you know, in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Point Market.
No, I mean, we all have to recognize, you know, food, food is a logistical nightmare. I mean, anyone who's dealt with quantities of food, or even, you know, at the end of the summer, all year ripe tomatoes at one time, it's a challenge. It's a logistical challenge. I mean, it's highly perishable. You either have to do very real-time delivery for fresh and untreated products, or you have to immediately do some kind of processing or controlled atmosphere storage, or preserving it in some way. We know there's great variability in the quality and quantity of production. It can be by region. It can be over time. It's highly, the logistics of food, very, very difficult. And this kind of all adds up to what I like to describe as the watermelon problem. So, watermelon, you know, huge, massive fruits. And it can be that, you know, we're in a time maybe of a bumper crop. I've got a bumper crop. All my neighbors in my area that are growing watermelon have got a bumper crop. And there's only so much market capacity for the watermelon. There's only so much you can sell to a store. There's only so much you can donate to food banks. And it's even more complicated if some of that watermelon is what I call cosmetically challenged. You know, it's got the blemish, it's maybe miscolored or some other reason. What are you going to do with it? And this is where I see some very creative, innovative people getting into this scene. And I think watermelon actually could be one of the most difficult, products to deal with. But even with watermelon, we're seeing a new enterprise entering into this market, and they're creating watermelon water. So it's the first time that I've ever seen watermelon being turned into a juice and then being distributed to consumers. And it's a very healthy product, and this product actually got a lot of buzz recently because Beyoncé is one of their investors. But those kind of innovations, I think, are going to be important as we start to think about how we deal with the difficult logistics of food and produce in particular.
Mm-hmm. I've also tried pickled watermelon rind. Have you had that?
Oh, I love it. I actually love it. And I would say that even this watermelon water company, they are claiming that they're using 99% of each melon and that they're feeding the skin into livestock production. But you're right. We have to get more sophisticated about using all of the fruit, all of the produce. And it's interesting to see celebrity chefs jumping into some of this challenge. With new recipes, kind of like you were talking about in the beginning, new recipes to use all of the product and hopefully feed people.
Was introduced to, I think, one of the most, for me, it was the most exciting thing. I went to Feeding the 5,000. I know you had it in Washington also, with a great nonprofit, and they took all the donated food that otherwise would have been wasted and turned it into meals, you know, with famous chefs cooking it, meals for 5,000 homeless people and 5,000 New Yorkers, and I guess in Washington it was 5,000 Washington guys. But, you know, the parts of the vegetable that are always thrown out, I know Dan Barber actually opened his restaurant doing just, you know, serving meals just with food that otherwise would have been thrown out and showing the quality you could do. But at this event, they showed taking the ends of the leeks, the tops of the leeks that we all throw out, or if maybe you make stock with it, but otherwise it just ends up in the compost bin or the garbage. Anyway, cutting it into spaghetti shapes and boiling it and making like linguine with the tops of the leeks, and then putting sauce on it and eating it like, you know, any type of veggetti, zucchini or anything like that. But
I think, you know, all of that kind of taps into this a more general statement about the need to educate consumers about how to prepare food from scratch and how to store it safely, even for long periods of time, maybe a little blanching and then putting it in your freezer. But just a more, we just need better education about food, cooking, preserving, storing, just all about food.
Right. Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. I was going away a couple of weeks ago, and I had all these vegetables in my refrigerator. And before doing it, I, like, stir-fried them all, and then I froze them so that I had, like, sautéed greens in the freezer, because otherwise it would have been, it would have gone bad. So,
right, right. And I think a lot of us just forget to do that. We look at something rotting slowly in our cellar drawer instead of thinking, okay, all I have to do is just, like you say, just quickly blanch it, pop it in the freezer, and I'm good to go.
Right. I had all these mushrooms. Again, they were going to go bad. I just made a mushroom gravy frozen, and then I have a mushroom gravy. But the problem is
right.
We run out of freezer space, too.
Right. Well, I mean, it's interesting. There are resources, of course, out there already to help educate consumers about this. One thing I don't know if you know about it is the National Center for Home Food Preservation. It's a great resource. It has lots of information on, you know, tips for preserving and, like, for freezing, canning, curing, drying, fermenting, pickling, making jams and jellies. It's all up there. It's a great resource. So it's called the National Center for Home Food Preservation.
Great. Thank you. I will definitely share that with everybody as well on my newsletter. That's wonderful to know. And I know there's been a lot of work with fermenting now also as a wonderful way to enhance our health and also preserve foods. One thing I wanted to ask you about, is the USDA addressing the problem of this monoculture and looking at diversification a little bit? Because I know I've talked to many farmers who are so concerned when we grow only one type of crop, if we have some sort of pest infestation, it wipes it all out, you know, like the plague, you know, the potato plague in Ireland, or, you know, something like that. So are we looking at trying to diversify a little bit?
Sure. I mean, there are a lot of programs to help farmers do multi-system cropping, to adopt cover cropping practices, and, of course, no-till as well. You also may be interested in our agroforestry center. And I think some of the most interesting work on how we actually build systems that not only, you know, help with greenhouse gases, but actually help to sequester greenhouse gas is the agroforestry systems, and I think that's a fascinating avenue to explore. And USDA, as I said, has its agroforestry center completely dedicated to looking at this issue and how to build up these types of more complicated and sophisticated systems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that whole area gets back into also people needing to eat less meat so that we don't have to keep knocking down these rainforests and these forests to create more grazing land for the animals that we need to grow to feed people. So, you know,
one thing I like to think about, as you're mentioning this approach of building a sustainable food system by focusing on specific commodities like, you know, meat and not meat and this kind of things. You know, that's an interesting approach. I prefer a systems approach. You know, I like to think of a systematic approach to how we're building more sustainable food systems. And this is very similar, actually, you mentioned before Dan Barber and his book on, or his approach to this, as is reflected in his book, The Third Plate.
Uh-huh.
I like to think about how, you know, how we reward that rancher who's developed an integrated system for grazing her cattle, for improving soil quality of pasture land, for growing forest buffers to preserve water quality. I like to think about how we build on the efforts of farmers who are working to improve nutrient use efficiency and reduce greenhouse gas emissions, including to sequester carbon on farms.
Right.
And I like to think about how we reward and support fishermen who contribute to the sustainable management of fish stocks. You know, so I'm very much of a systems approach person, and I like the systems thinking as we layer, as we think about how to build a sustainable food system. That word system is so key. And I definitely think, as we talked about in the beginning of this conversation, that reducing food loss and waste is absolutely should be a major focal point of how we're moving forward on this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as we said before, the numbers are just too big, and the impacts are too important.
Right, and I couldn't agree with you more. When you talk about systems, it's how it's all integrated. Everything is connected, and I talk about that all the time. You can't look at just one part without looking at another part because it's all connected. So going back to food waste and loss, how does the USDA measure food loss and waste?
So in the U.S., we have two very different ways that we're measuring this and trying to get a handle on the magnitude of the problem. We have EPA that actually measures the amount of food, organic food waste, that's going into our landfills. And then USDA, we measure at the end of the chain how much food is lost or wasted at the retail and consumer level. And we do that by using some of our nationally representative surveys that look at the difference between what is purchased and what is consumed. And so that's how we come up with that estimate of food loss and waste at the end of the chain. And that's the number that most people are familiar with if they're familiar with the topic of food loss and waste in the U.S. That's the 30% number that we all hear thrown around. And that 30% in 2010 represented about 133 billion pounds of food.
133 billion pounds of food wasted?
Yes, and that, as we say, lost or wasted, and that equals about, according to USDA estimates in 2010, that was equal to about $162 billion worth of food.
Is that in one year?
Yeah, these are massive. And when you, massive
numbers,
impacts of that much waste, you think about the impacts on food security. Feeding America, which you know is a big food bank system in the United States, they estimate that they have recovered, you know, helping to improve food security in this country, that they've recovered about 2.5 billion pounds of wholesome food that otherwise would have gone to waste. But they estimate that there's still about 70 billion pounds of potentially usable food that's lost or wasted in the U.S. that could be recovered to feed people in need. So that's one impact. We know it can have a big impact on improving food security if we didn't waste so much food. We also know that food loss and waste is very expensive for families, for households. And because it's so expensive, it erodes or changes the way that we think about the affordability of nutritious, healthy diets. USDA estimates that the average American buys about $371 of food per year that he or she doesn't eat. And for a family of four, that adds up to about $1,500 per year. You know, that's a lot of healthy food that family could have afforded, but instead is thrown away. And then we know that the environmental impacts of food loss and waste are also enormous. You think about all the land, water, labor, energy, and other inputs that go into producing, transporting, processing, distributing, and preparing the food. It's huge. Researchers estimate that food that's harvested globally but it's not consumed accounts for about 25% of all water used in agriculture each year. This requires cropland the size of China and generates about 8% of global greenhouse gas emissions annually. And according to the United Nations, if food loss and waste were a country, it would be the world's third largest greenhouse gas emitter behind China and the United States. So we know that food loss and waste has huge impacts on our food security, on the way affordability of food for families, and on the environment, and on climate change. So we know that this really is an important issue and is fundamental to building more sustainable food supply chains.
Wow, those numbers are staggering.
Aren't they? I don't know if you already know this, but in the United States, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency estimates that food is the single largest component of our everyday trash. Okay, the single largest component of what we're throwing into landfills, and that landfills in the United States are one of the very largest sources of methane.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Elisa, I want to take a couple minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to hear of the ways that your department is combating some of these. What are some of the solutions that you are coming up with to address some of these incredible, staggering numbers? Okay, so don't go anywhere. Great. Everyone listening, we're just going to take a couple minute break. We'll be right back. I'm talking with Dr. Elise Golan from the Sustainable Department at the USDA. Be right back. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I'm here with my guest, Dr. Elise Golan, the Director for Sustainable Development at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Elise, are you with me?
Yep, here I am.
Great. So before we took a break, I just wanted to go back to looking at the ways that the department is trying to address some of these huge issues on food waste. What kind of programs are you setting up? And then maybe you can also share with my listeners what they can do, because I know at the beginning I talked about policy and how we all have to get involved, you know, what things people can do to help make some of these changes happen.
Right. Well, I think that for food loss and waste, there's something very interesting. Is that very, you know, as just a single consumer, as you say, we sometimes think, okay, we have to change policy. We have to somehow do something that's very big, and that's right. I mean, that's always important to do. But when it comes to food loss and waste, because so much of the problem is at the household level, you know, our estimates say that 21% of the food supply is wasted at the household level. So given that that's where so much of our waste is happening, it really is incumbent on us as individual consumers to think about what we can do in our homes and how we can educate our communities about what's happening in our homes. These are individual actions that are going to be important. And because we recognize that, one thing that USDA has very recently done is developed an infographic called Let's Talk Trash. And we've actually put it up on the choosemyplate.gov website. And as you know, Choose My Plate is the educational arm of the Dietary Guidelines for Americas. That's where we're putting up that dietary advice on the myplate.gov site. We're just this last September put up on that site the Let's Talk Trash infographic and the tips for reducing food loss and waste in the household, because, you know, it's going to save consumers money and it's going to help them stretch their household budgets to afford more healthy foods and, you know, reduce impact on the environment down the line. So if you go to that website, we have up there these great tips for what we all can do in our household. And I'm sure this is going to just resonate with you and your listeners. So the first thing you want to do before you go into the grocery store is make a list. So this is number one, make a list. Get your game plan in your head, get yourself organized, you're going to save money, and you're going to make better food choices and pick healthier options once you get to the store. Number two, you want to make sure that you're storing foods quickly and safely after you get them home. We've already talked about. Number three, you want to check for quality the food in your pantries, but you don't want to overreact to date labels. Remember that most date labels on a food are providing information on quality, but not safety. And the only date label that is required by the federal government is the date label on infant formula. And that's to make sure that the nutritional quality of the product exists for infants who are, you know,
depending on it. Right,
depending on it, okay? But otherwise, you know, these date labels are all about quality. You don't have to throw your Oreos away if you've passed the date label, you know? Taste them. Are they still good? Go ahead and eat them. The Natural Resource Defense Council estimates that 90% of Americans throw away food according to the label date because they are afraid of safety risks. But, mm-hmm. you know, really we have to use common sense when it comes to labels. Mm-hmm. If I leave my milk in my hot car while I'm doing the rest of my shopping during the day, that milk is going to spoil before the sell-by date. If I keep it in the back of the refrigerator, you know, maybe it's going to be good for good week after the sell-by date. We have to mm-hmm. use common sense and safe handling techniques when we think about these sell-by dates and what they mean. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then number four on our list, on our website, on tips on Let's Talk Trash, you want to repurpose those leftovers. As we were talking before, you know, the bits and pieces that are left over from a meal or from meal preparation, you can use them in other meals, and you can, of course, freeze them. Another thing you want to think about is organizing your fridge. A lot of people are using the a basket system with eat-me-first baskets in the front of a fridge to remind people to eat that product first. Another thing people can do is set store reminders. USDA has developed a Food Keeper app that you can download into your smartphone when you're shopping, and it gives you specific tips on storage timelines for refrigerator, freezer, and pantry, depending on the nature of the product. So you can better calculate how long you can keep foods when you're buying them. And also remember, we've talked about this before, to donate. Non-perishable, unspoiled perishable food can be donated to local charities, including many foods past their sell-by dates. This is one thing that a lot of people, the interesting kind of program that I've heard about is that a lot of people, when they're moving, they don't want to move their pantries. There's a number of services across the country that will come and take everything out of your pantry and donate it to, you know, soup kitchens and food banks in local communities. And, of course, remember, if at the end of the chain there you really do have some leftovers that you cannot use, or maybe it's the inedible parts of your food, go ahead and compost it. You know, that keeps it out of our landfills, reduces greenhouse gas emissions. And if you can't compost in your own home, maybe you live in an apartment house in a very dense city, there are a lot of new services that will come and pick up your composting for you. I know in the D.C. area we have one of the collection services is called Compost Cab, and they'll come around and pick up composting. In a number of other cities, I've heard about innovative kind of collaboration between car services like Zipcar and those kind of services, where they'll those companies will give the cars to college students in the area for them to go ahead and pick up compost or to pick up wholesome food and get it to food banks. So a lot of innovative ways to make sure your food's not ending up in a landfill.
Mm-hmm. I know as a chef, you know, sometimes I have spices, and the spices don't go bad, but sometimes they're just weaker, you know, so I have to, instead of one teaspoon, I put in two teaspoons, you know, and that's where taste comes in if you're cooking.
Right. You don't have to throw it away, you know, give a little taste, use common sense.
Right, right. Well, those are all great tips, and all of those people will find on the choosemyplate.gov website, correct?
Right. They can do it there, and, you know, or you can just go ahead and Google Let's Talk Trash. So Let's Talk Trash, and it'll take you right to that website.
Uh-huh. Great. Now, do you think if we address food waste, it will lead to a reduction in food prices or higher incomes for farmers?
You know, it's really difficult to know what the actual impact will be down the line. You know, if we had a huge reduction in food waste, it really depends on how we achieve it. Because not everything we've been discussing now is costless. You know, some of these new innovative approaches or new systems approaches will actually, particularly in the short run, involve new higher costs. If we're setting up a new system to make sure that food does not go into a landfill, that's not necessarily going to be the least cost solution right now. You know, the environmental benefits and other benefits may outweigh those costs. But right now, given, you know, current prices, current costs, a lot of these options that we've been discussing could actually involve higher costs. And so I always caution people to be very careful in some of these statements that I've heard, in echoing these statements that I've heard, that if we reduce food loss and waste, all of a sudden we'll be able to feed the world and food will be cheaper and all these other wonderful things will happen. It's just more complicated than that, and we just have to be careful in how we do these types of analyses and make these statements.
Right. I think it's also really important for people to realize that good food is worth the money. I mean, we're in such an economy that people want everything cheap. And in most countries, people spend a lot more of their earned income on food than we do in this country. Here, we're so used to the big box stores and getting everything in bulk and cheap. And when I grow a head of lettuce and I see the amount of work it takes with myself and a handful of interns to produce vegetables out of my garden with hand weeding and hand harvesting and hand producing and cleaning, and it is a lot of work, and people need to be paid for that. And I think people just have to start realizing that, you know, spending money on food is more important than, you know, having the latest Michael Jordan sneakers, you know.
Right. I mean, I'm always actually myself surprised at how much work and effort and resources go into producing food and how relatively inexpensive it is. But I do want to point out that often when we make those statements about, in the United States, the average consumer only pays about 10% or less of their income on food, and that compares, you know, very favorably to other countries in the world. But nevertheless, for lower-income households in the United States, they're paying on average about 30% of their income on food. That's a huge part of their budget. And so, you know, the price of food is still extremely important for a lot of people. But having said that, I think that we do need to realign ourselves of how we think about the value of food. And so often I see people comparing food by price per pound, and they'll say, lettuce is so expensive because compared to, I don't even know, soda or something. Much of that is a price per pound comparison. But when we start to think in our heads about a price per nutrient, price per good nutrition, and we start to think about our diets that way, you come up with a different way of calculating the value of different comparisons that you make when you're shopping. And the Economic Research Service of USDA has put out, I think twice now, different types of comparisons of the prices of different foods depending on your unit of analysis, whether it's by the pound, whether it's by the serving, whether it's by different types of nutritional components. And I think that's just a very interesting analysis to look at.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with you there, for sure. And, Elise, we are just about out of time. This has gone by so fast. I have so many more questions that I wanted to ask you that I didn't get to, but we'll just have to do it another time. I want to thank you so much for joining me today on the show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Sure, and the work you're doing is so important. So thank you on behalf of everybody. Thanks for the work you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks.
Sure. And everybody out there, thank you so much for joining me today on the IE Green Show. I will be with you again next week. Stay dry, enjoy the beautiful weather, shop at farmers markets, use your food up so that you don't have food waste. Give it away, donate it, create things, freeze it. And as Dr. Golan said, go to Let's Talk Trash on the USDA website, choosemyplate.gov, and see what things you can do to reduce your own food waste. Everyone, sign those petitions, be active, and have a great rest of the week. See you again next week. Bye for now.